Ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, America and the world? This is Tim Banal, banalofamerica.com, Banal of America Audio, Season 1. We continue this week, October 8th, 2005, Robert Miles. Those of you who were part of the X-Conference sessions, if you've heard them already, you know Robert Miles. He guested on the July 9th edition of Banal of America Audio X-Conference Sessions. Unfortunately, we conducted that interview at the National Press Club right before the X-Conference press conference, so Robert only had about 5 minutes of time. So when we put together Banal of America Audio Season 1, we tracked down Robert Miles to get much more time. Instead of 5 minutes, we're doing an hour and 15. We're covering his entire experience and his work since then and his upcoming film. The interview was recorded July 29th, 2005. I do the lengthy bio and all that jazz in the actual interview for a change. So let's rock and roll. Banal of America Audio Season 1 continues with Robert Miles.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Banal of America Audio, and I want to welcome my special guest this week, Robert Miles. For those of you who listen to Banal of America Audio, the X-Conference sessions, you're familiar with Robert Miles, not only from his brief interview that we conducted before the X-Conference press conference, but also he was a part of the historic Monsignor Corrado Balducci interview we conducted. And here's a little bit about Robert Miles before we kick it off here. He's a television and motion picture writer, producer, with 30 years' experience. He's written and published numerous articles and nonfiction stories. He's an avid adventurer. He designed and built 4 sailing vessels, cruised to Hawaii, Baja, Mexico, and Honduras. And he had an experience in the early 1970s with an extraterrestrial encounter that is remarkable. And I'd say it probably changed his life forever. And Robert Miles, welcome to Banal of America Audio, and I'm glad we finally have this chance to have a lengthier conversation.
Hey, thank you very much for having the interview, Tim, and looking forward to talking to you and to all those individuals that take advantage of your website or downloads.
Nice, nice. So why don't you tell me a little bit about your life before the whole encounter in the early 70s?
Well, I was actually living in the area of Portland, Oregon, and I was a life insurance salesman selling death, basically, and it had reached a point in my life where I just wanted something more, so I sold my property and I began to get involved in boats and sailing vessels. Ended up building a 47-foot trimaran, which was a very advanced vessel for its time, which would be the late, about 1967-68. It's a three-hulled sailing vessel, and it's capable of ocean crossing and cruising. So myself and my partner spent a couple of years building this vessel, and then we sailed from Portland, Oregon. Didn't know how to navigate, didn't know how to sail, but we taught ourselves those things, and we sailed down the Oregon coast and down to California and then on over to Hawaii, which was a voyage of 2,400 miles. After living on the boat for a couple of years in the islands, my life reached a point where it just seemed like there ought to be more to life, that there ought to be something that went beyond just the day-to-day partying. And, you know, we had the idyllic life. We had a vessel that we lived aboard that was totally self-contained. And for as little as 50 cents a day, which basically paid our propane, we could surf and we could party and we could skin dive and
wow,
do all the things that people do in the islands. And after a couple of years of that, I reached the point where I knew I wanted to do something more with my life, and I decided to sell the boat, and with my partner's agreement, put an ad in the paper, and we sold it to a fellow there, and he was coming one morning to take delivery of the vessel, and I knew my life was changing, and I had set the alarm clock for very early, about 4:30. And although I woke up without it, and on my boat I had a large double bunk with a skylight over the bunk, and so I got up and I made myself some coffee, and I took a cup of coffee back to my bunk, and I was laying on my bunk looking through the skylight, just kind of enjoying the beautiful sunrise and morning there. And this was at Alawai Yacht Harbor in Honolulu, Hawaii, where my boat was moored at the time. And all of a sudden, the most incredible feeling of energy just completely enveloped me. And I knew instantly that something unbelievable was happening. And at first, I thought I was dreaming because this beautiful woman materialized in the stateroom right next to me where I was laying on the bed. And she was gorgeous. She was totally human-looking, except that her energy field and the energy field that radiated during this entire time was just incredible. And the only thing I can liken it to is like a person knows what 110 feels like if they stick their finger in a socket. Well, this was like 220 or 440, except it was just exotic feeling. It just was the most pleasant, wonderful sensation that I've ever experienced in my entire life. And of course, I thought I was dreaming, and I said out loud, I said, I must be dreaming. And she said, no, you're not. And I said, but this can't be happening. This just can't be real.
Now,
and she said, well, it is.
What did you think? And you just thought you were dreaming at the time.
Absolutely. I thought I was dreaming or hallucinating. I was wide awake and fully clothed, but she was there, and she told me, she said, you know, touch me, you know, feel my body, this is really happening. And I said, well, who are you? And she said, well, we're friends, and we want you to come to a briefing, and we want you to be part of an undertaking that's happening here on planet Earth. And I said, well, you know, definitely. And people have asked me, they've asked, were you abducted? And I said, absolutely not. I went totally willingly. And she told me that I would take a trip to New York, and there I would board a saucer or spacecraft, and from there I would go to a briefing on another planet. And she said, just close your eyes and decide you're there. And I said, I can't do that. And she said, yes, you can. We'll help you. And so I did, and the next instant, I was in LaGuardia Airport in New York City. And there I boarded a saucer. At the time, I didn't know what kind of a craft it was. I went aboard. It was a large docking area that was there. I went aboard, and there were some other people that were aboard the craft. And when the craft took off, I actually looked out through like a porthole-like window, and I could see the Earth moving away from me at a very, very rapid rate. It was a beautiful feeling, and the trip was actually to the planet Jupiter. And I know that it sounds incredibly fantastic and not possible, but what I think it was, Tim, was I think I was aboard like an interdimensional craft, because when I spoke with them about it, and I landed, like I say, in about 20 minutes and departed. And as I walked down the ramp area, I looked back, and it was a saucer-shaped craft, disc shape, that is like you'd see in a lot of the films and the movies. And it was probably 150 feet in diameter, quite a large craft.
Wow.
And what I said is, how can this be happening? And I still couldn't believe it. And all around me, when I was on the planet Jupiter, there was this incredible sense of this energy. And she was there to meet me. And she actually acted as kind of like my tour guide, if you want to call it that. As Robert Dean said, they gave you the 29-cent tour, you know.
What's that?
When I talked with Bob Dean about the experience,
yeah,
he said, well, they gave you the 29-cent tour. They took you to Jupiter, you know. So there was just the whole sky and the whole area of the planet that I was on was in vibrating with this incredible luminescence and energy, and the sky was beautiful pinks and blue and had the most incredible iridescence to it that you can possibly imagine. And it's an experience that totally changed my life. While I was there, they briefed me on some of the things that were possibly going to happen to the planet Earth in the years ahead. And I agreed to take on a mission and to help bring information and to help assist in making sure that the planet didn't have to go through all that chaos and catastrophe that seemed to be looming in its path. And I was there what seemed to be maybe 8 or 10 hours, but I actually went out on the area that was like a beach there, and there was like a liquid sea, although it wasn't water, it was more kind of a luminous, metallic-looking liquid, but people were swimming and things. And again, I spoke with the lady, and she said, it is happening, and it is real, and you're not dreaming or hallucinating. And then she said, there's someone back aboard your boat that wants you. Just decide that you're there, and you'll be there. And I did, and I was. And when I got back to the boat, only about 33 minutes had passed. But it seemed like I had been gone for, you know, eight or maybe 10 hours. And so there was a time dilation effect there.
Wow.
And there was also the interdimensionality aspect of it. And after that, I wrote a story, and over a period of about a year and a half, I sold it to Columbia Pictures and spent 2 years working with them prior to Star Wars, making a screenplay, a script about the safe space story and the experience. But it never went into principal production because the screenwriter that they hired, they turned my good guy, who is one of the people that briefed me, into an assassin, and we could never get the script right. It was basically a story of hope and a story of a benefit for the planet and the Earth. And what they were looking to do, or at least he was turn it into some kind of a, you know, action thriller with all the negativity coming from the side of the extraterrestrials. And it just certainly wasn't the case, because I have never, since that time, been exposed to or been around individuals or beings, if you would want to call them ETs or angels or extraterrestrials, that had a greater desire to help the planet than these beings did.
All right. Well, let's go back to some the story here. Your experience. I had some questions that were like popping into my head, but I didn't want to interrupt you because I was really getting into the story. So, let's start with you. She said you can touch her, right?
Right.
What did she feel like?
She felt just like I was touching an ordinary human being. Flesh.
Really?
And bone, yeah.
And
absolutely. So she wasn't a projection. And, or, you know.
She didn't feel like any different, like, cold or slimy or anything like that?
No, absolutely not. And again, she had this radiant aura of energy. And it's interesting, if you look at the pictures of some of the early Renaissance paintings and things where they show, you know, holy figures with some type of an aura around them.
Yeah.
That glow. It might be a representational way of showing what the emanation was actually like. I didn't see a glow around her, but I did definitely experience the vibratory rate of energy that radiated from her being in my proximity. And it wasn't just her, it was also other beings on the planet Jupiter.
And then
the same radiant aura.
Huh. And then you went to LaGuardia Airport. Whereabouts in LaGuardia were you? Like, do you have any idea in retrospect?
Well, yeah, I materialized right into the main terminal in the passenger ticketing area, and she had told me to go up. And this is a funny part of the story because it's so outrageous. She told me to go up and ask for a ticket on the Jupiter flight, and that I wouldn't need any money. And so I did, and the ticketing agent gave me the ticket and indicated that I should walk over to the area where that led to the boarding area. So what seemed to be going on, and I believe this is true to this day, that there's another dimension that we're actually capable of interfacing with, if our resonant frequency or our vibratory rate is at that level. Because I could see other people around me, but they were not aware of me in the same sense that I was aware of them. They were going about their day-to-day business as if there was nothing unusual at all going on. And what I was told is that saucers come and go from various points all over the planet on a regular basis, and they simply change their vibratory rate. And, of course, you know, in Star Trek or something, they call it cloaking or whatever.
Yeah.
But remember, this occurred, and I wrote it all down back in, like I say, about 1972 was when I wrote the first manuscript that was called Project Safe Space, which is what the book Safe Space is an expansion of. And all of this was in there. It was also interesting. We're now working on a documentary that you and I talked about when we were at the X conference.
Yeah.
But I happened to see a Hubble telescope shot of Jupiter, and it's an amazing shot because it shows the beautiful colors of Jupiter, the greens and the pinks and the lavenders and the most incredible pastel energy colors that you've ever seen. So you get a chance for your viewers to go up and look at one of the Hubble images of the planet Jupiter, and you'll see what the sky and everything look like.
Yeah.
But there is this interdimensional aspect to my experience that, you know, it logically defies that definition, especially in the 70s. Now, with them talking about the multiverse and possibly 30 dimensions or more, it begins to make sense, you know. They're also talking about the resonant frequency of things being one of the things that represents the key to entering or departing those kind of energy levels.
Now, when you were riding to Jupiter, were there other people on board with you?
Yes, there were. And people have said, well, did you ask these people a lot of questions and, you know, what did they have to say and that type of thing? And,
yeah.
And, you know, and what comes to mind on that is that I was so amazed and astounded by this entire experience that I really was listening more than I was asking or talking. I was just absolutely in a raptured state, if I could use that term, that this entire experience was happening to me. It was beyond belief. So I wasn't asking a lot of questions of people or things. I was experiencing it, and it was absolutely the most amazing thing that's ever happened in my life. My life has never been the same since.
It sounds that way. Now, the briefing aspect of your visit to Jupiter, what were some of the specifics of the briefing?
Well, you know, there's a part of it that you hear every day now. But again, back in the 70s, it was a little different. A lot of it had to do with cataclysm and catastrophes that would happen to the planet. And it had to do with the collapse of our civilized systems, you know, the electricity, the transit system, the shortages of food. There was natural disasters, and there were also potential proliferation, war, and insanity disasters. And the briefing that I went to, what was imparted to me is that I was just one of a large number of people that were being briefed and had been briefed, and that a team of people would come together and be able to help avert a great deal of the disasters that were forthcoming. And we were instructed to create models, working models, not just a little plastic model, but an actual creation of a vessel called the Safe Space One, which would be a complete survival vessel and would be capable of demonstrating to people that they could be safe and secure and that mankind could work together. The story, Safe Space, is about the coming together of a group of people gathered from all over the world, men and women from every walk of life and every occupation to come together and build a ship as an example of peace and sanity in a time when the world is beginning to come apart. The time, you know, we're facing times like that now. And I think that the timing of the project and the advent of some of those cataclysmic activities are right in our face. You know, they're coming up very, very suddenly.
Now, did they say why they chose you to invite into this mission?
No, they really didn't. I think, you know, I've often tried to logically understand that.
Yeah.
I had done meditation during the time that I was in the islands and different things. I've had a lot of very diverse religious background. Had tried to understand who I was and what was going on the planet, why I was here, you know, what is life all about, that type of thing. But I was totally open to the idea of a higher intelligence and hopefully that mankind had a purpose, you know, other than just partying.
Yeah.
And enjoying themselves, which was basically what I had been doing for a couple of years.
And there were other people from Earth in this briefing with you? Like, did they just bring you in, or was it like a group of people?
No, it was a group of people. And part of that, it seems to me that part of the actual information in the briefing is revealed to me as kind of time goes on.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people out there that are prophesized, and they give all of these statements as to what's coming in the future, and that's never been the case with me. I've never tried or attempted to make a single prediction or prophecy. I just know that I agreed to be a part of a team of people that would come together and help benefit the people here on this planet. And in the course of my book being out there, and after it was published, which was the second time, which was in the Safe Space edition, which is there on Amazon, they actually have been a number of people that have emailed me and told me about similar experiences, that they felt that they might be part of that team. And we've been working as a small team now, a number of people from Germany and Bulgaria and different parts of the world have come together, and our first step is we're doing a documentary on UFOs and aliens and what's really going on there that really pushes the disclosure line, that we feel strongly that disclosure needs to happen, and we totally support the ideals and goals of not only the X conference but the UFO conferences and things that people are doing now, like yourself, Tim.
Well, you know,
get the word and the truth out there.
Yeah, we all got to do our part here, you know, get the word out and get some answers, you know what I mean? Wow, I could ask you so many questions here about this group. So you never really ran into did you ever run into any of the other people, like, that you were in the briefing with ever again? Like, you ever see them afterwards at all? Sort of just, or was it like after the book came out, then you started hearing from other people?
Exactly, and as you're aware, I've been interviewed on some other talk shows and radio shows,
yeah.
And after those, I tend to get activity from people on the website. You know, a couple of times I've tried to push the button and really tried to start building the ship. One of the things that I did do is build a 65-foot catamaran sailing vessel after the one we sold in Hawaii and several others as prototype vessels, but I have not been able to pull together the team or the financial resources to build the actual Safe Space One, which is one of the goals of the mission. And that's a 350-foot-long vessel.
Oh, wow.
That has, you know, so much living space and room for horticulture aboard, and is totally capable of transversing the oceans of the world in safety and harmony with a plan to be out there demonstrating that people from all walks of life and all nationalities can work together. I just can't accept this war and insanity that mankind seems to continuously be involved in.
Exactly. Now, have you had, since that early 70s encounter, have you had any more encounters with the extraterrestrials since?
You know, I've had an experience where I did see a couple of other orbs. That was nothing that has involved the direct communication like occurred at that time, though. And I've often wondered why, and I wished I knew the answer. You know, I'm totally ready for it again.
Yeah, but there's been no communication at all, huh?
Well, I've, at times I've thought there's been communication, and part of that has been, part of that communication occurred while I was rewriting the book. I thought that I was given more insights.
Oh, really?
I chose to write the book as a combination science fiction and factual. You know, there's elements of that book that are part of the briefing. There's also elements that are put in there simply for the fun of it.
Now, why did that's you actually kind of touched on one of my questions here. So, why did you choose to do it to write the book that way, where it was like a science fiction adventure that was based on your real life experiences? Was it a product of the time and the era where, you know, a UFO book, like a straight UFO book, just didn't have much of a shot at getting out there, or was it an artistic decision, or what made you decide to write it as fiction?
Well, one of the things is that Safe Space is a story of hope, and it's a story of people discovering who they are and what the planet is that here on planet Earth. Like one of the major premises there is that we live basically on a prison planet. That Earth is a prison planet, and that the leaders taken from all over the universe have been gathered and placed here and involved in games of war, and they never really realize who they are or why they're here, and they go on lifetime after lifetime that way. The fictional aspects of this story were designed to put it into a light that's acceptable to the general public. One of the problems that ufology has, as you're aware, is that we tend to be just a group of people. You know, it's like a niche. And there's a much broader public out there that are interested in the subject. And adding the fictional aspects to it was to make it more interesting to those people. Even if they're a younger reader, you know, maybe 12, 13, 14 years of age,
yeah,
that they could enjoy the story too. And also that it doesn't need to be so heavy, because, you know, if you look at it from one side, it's really scary and it's really gloomy.
Yeah.
But if you look at it from the other side, which is the side that there is intelligent individuals or beings out there that are willing to help us as a civilization, it's an amazing story and it's a fun story. So I tried to combine those elements. And rather than just making it a straight, true story.
And so this happened in the early 70s, and then you wrote the book a couple of years after that, you said?
Yeah. The book, Columbia Pictures bought the rights to the story in about 1972, late 1972. And it was published as what I call a pre-production manuscript. It wasn't in a traditional book form. It was spiral-bound.
Yeah.
And that's what they bought. And then after a number of years, I got the rights to that back after Columbia didn't proceed. Then I went ahead and published it as you're aware in its present form, which is just a standard trade paperback.
And what were you doing in the time between when the book came out and like recently? That's like a long period of time. Were you just getting into the UFO field and trying to network and stuff and meet other people who were doing the same kind of research, or what were you up to then?
Well, actually, I became involved in communications industry. I became a television producer.
Okay.
Worked with community television in San Diego, wrote for one of the San Diego newspapers, published a magazine on gold mining and adventure, became very involved in making our own adventure documentaries, and also in having a public relations ad agency, which we ran for about 20 years.
Oh, wow.
During that time, always wanting to have the ability or the capability to to launch the Safe Space project, which would involve the creation of the ship itself and a feature film, which would be a way to put the story out there. You know, a lot has been done in science fiction, you know, since the 70s.
Yeah.
And when I originally wrote it, it was before Star Wars, and Michael Graskoff, the producer of Silent Running, was the producer that bought the story. And I don't know if you remember that one. It was the little robots, Huey, Dewey, and Louie, up on a big orbiting space platform.
That might be a little bit before my time.
Before your time.
Yeah.
But I also worked with Douglas Trumbull, who did 2001, special effects for 2001. Had a real good team. I wished it had gone forward, but it didn't. But it's been, all those years that passed, it was my goal to hold together not only the building of the boat, but the creation of the motion picture. And now with the advent of new digital communications and computers, you know, it gets more and more likely that an individual rather than a large studio could possibly do something like that.
And so, well, let's talk a little bit about what you were working on at the X conference, because I saw you have you were talking about the Fast Walkers files on your website too. So, what now? It's like a video news magazine type of thing on ufology.
Well, it's actually you know, larger than just ufology.
Okay, yeah.
Ufology is Fast Walker Files is the concept. There is that there's a number of things, number of concepts that the world at large needs to know about, to have the facts and the truth about, that there needs to be disclosure about. And the first episode is the one on disclosure, which is dealing with UFOs and ETs and the alien cover-up. So that's number one. Video magazine in the sense that there would be additional subjects that we would tackle in the years ahead. And we've been working on this particular venture now since we actually began filming at the UFO conference in Laughlin and then went on to the X conference in Washington.
Oh, wow.
There where I met you. We interviewed probably close to 50 of the top guns in the field about their views on what's going on in the subject. And we're currently editing together those interviews along with a little bit of narration into a product that'll be available hopefully by Christmas time.
Oh, wow. Nice. And that's like a discussion with the various big names in ufology about what they think is going on?
Yeah, exactly. And it also tries to present what we're trying to do is gather clips and footage and stills and pictures. And I invite anyone out there that has any type of pictures or videos or anything to contact us. We'd love to have access to put some of that into the feature itself. But we want to, you know, there's just so much going on, like with AJ down in Brazil.
Yeah.
And with Jaime Masson and with, you know, even Phoenix, Arizona, they're having sightings on a regular basis. So just all over, it's just the whole field is just filled with things developing every day. And we're trying to include, prior to the final edit, we'll try to include as much as we can of what is actually taking place.
So back to this briefing now, did they show you the history? No, I could have sworn to say that they showed you the history of the Earth or something like that.
Right, and a lot of that is in the Safe Space story.
Oh, it is?
Oh, yeah. It's you'll find that there's some parallels to Zachariah Sitchin stuff where he talks about the species being created here on this planet over 450,000 years ago. And the planet has had numerous contacts with extraterrestrial different species and coming here for different reasons and motivations. But from my standpoint, the Federation, which is talked about in detail in the Safe Space story, is like the controlling force or power in the universe. And they have a very tightly controlled structure, and anyone that deviates or anything that deviates from that control is managed, and sometimes is managed very harshly. So renegades, rebels, people that have their own pioneering spirit and want to do it their way are not looked upon well by the Federation. And a lot of them were gathered up over the era that the Federation became the dominant power in the universe. They gathered them up and they did reprogramming and that type of thing. But the real tough cases, they brought to planet Earth and they put here, and we remained here involved in games of peace and war, never knowing who we are or why we're here.
Wow. And did they say that the future will be natural catastrophes or war and all that sort of awful thing? And did they say there was a way to prevent it?
Well, actually, the Federation has, as you get into the safe space story, some of the stuff that came from the briefing is that on a regular basis, civilization is knocked down way below its knees on this planet. This planet is kept in a particular time era, and at that particular intelligence era, to where they never discover who they are or understand what's out there. And so there's a pre-planned shift of the planet's poles that are set in motion, almost like a pre-designed computer program that occurs on a regular basis and wipes out civilizations. Now, in the case of the Safe Space book, it talks about a mission being sent in ahead of time because some things had happened. And I don't want to get in and tell the whole story.
Oh, yeah.
Take your whole interview up to that. What happens is the Earth is scheduled for a tilt and a reduction of awareness because we're about to discover who we are and what's out there. And it's a lot more than just the activity in the local solar system or the local galaxy.
Yeah.
That the discovery is about. And a mission is sent here by the Federation under the command of Regent Varce to actually tilt the planet ahead of time. But Varce discovers a bit about who he really is and decides not to do that, to help the planet instead, and to gather a group of people that know what's going on and to change the course and the destiny, not only of planet Earth, but the entire universe.
Now, did the extraterrestrials tell you that we can prevent this this reset, so to speak, for lack of a better term, or is this just like is it just going to happen, or is there any way we can get past that?
We can definitely prevent it, and we can definitely work beyond it, and there's absolutely no reason why humanity, and not just humanity on this planet, but humanity at large can't have a dynamic and creative future rather than one of desolation and destruction.
So you've been in the UFO field for how long? Since the early 70s you had the experience, but now would you say you're pretty much like deep into the UFO field? How long have you really been made this what your hour schedule is like, but is it a full-time gig now for you working in the UFO field, or is it like...
Yeah, it pretty much is, and that's only been since I published the book, which would have been in about June of last year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's only been recently that I've been in the UFO field as what I would consider to be a real investigator, and that's why shows like yours and the X Conference and the UFO Conference is just an amazing and wonderful experience for me. To get out there and hear and see and meet these people, you know, and find out the information.
And so you collect a lot of information. What do you think about the big picture now? Do you think we're going to see disclosure in our lifetime, or do you think things are getting so awful on this planet that disclosure is getting further and further away?
Well, and that's a great question. I think that it's possible that we'll see a continuous dribble of disclosure information occurring, put out by the powers to be, because I think it's with the advent of the Internet, it's impossible to keep this thing covered up. And I think that all of the actions of people like yourself and Steve Nassett and some of the Jaime Masson and AJ and Jim Mars and all of the Robert Dean and all the terrific people out there is being taken right to the doorstep of everybody on the entire planet virtually that has any level of civilization and technology at all. So it's pretty hard to cover it up. And I think that we are going to see dynamic change also, though, from a political standpoint. I think we face a time when tight political control might throttle everything that we're about to find out.
Yeah, it seems like things are coming to a head here where either we're going to find out the answer or all hell's going to break loose.
Yeah. And I hope, and I also hope that we're able to survive some of the natural stuff that's coming, because there is, in my opinion, there's a natural series of events, a course of events that's beginning to take place where we're going to lose a lot of landmass to natural cataclysms. And there's going to be a lot of natural disasters that occur that so many of your psychics and your people who are doing the prophetic things have been talking about for a long, long time. I think that's going to also enter into the equation.
Now, from what the extraterrestrials told you, do you think that they would take the burden of disclosure out of our hands and do it themselves? Or do you think that's going to be dependent upon the Earth governments to disclose?
Well, I'd like to believe that they're going to just land a big spacecraft and, you know, or hover one above every major city out there, but I just don't, I don't have anything to base that on. I think that it has to do with a willingness on our part to do something about it. I don't think that, you know, it's like occupation of a foreign country. If you go in there and you occupy and you try to provide a lifestyle or a way of life or information by force, then usually the population rejects it. And I think they're very, very careful not to do that with us as a species. I think there's the people that are ready for it are listening with open ears, and I think more and more we're going to see them getting the information. And I think we will see maybe even countries that get disclosure, and I think it's going to be very difficult for a country like the United States to continue to ignore it, and that is what's happening now, as you know.
Yeah, it seems like some of the other countries in the world are sort of forcing the hand of the United States, like India and Brazil and some of those other countries that are having the ET experiences. They're sort of leaking out more and more information, and the U.S. government hasn't, they just sort of ignore it, but it's getting out there to us and stuff, so.
Yeah, I also don't think it's any accident that the shuttle program is being shut down, you know. I think that we're under very heavy, strict control.
Quarantine?
Quarantine, yeah. There's Deerdorf and Maccabee and some of them put off would say, definitely quarantine. And I think that we're dealing with a large number of races and species, and I think that they all have their own agenda, and I think there's an over-governing body at many different levels.
And what? And did they say to you that at some point we'll be allowed into this government?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that part of the problem and part of the struggle that has taken place and is taking place now is that there's more than one government, and there are two forces that are at odds with each other.
Really?
Absolutely.
And
I call them the Federation and the Confederation.
Okay.
And I think that the Federation, again, is outlined in the book, is very determined to control everything. And because, you know, with control, they can predict the future virtually 100%. With 100% control, but that's not necessarily the way an individual, a being who has the ability to create change experience things at so many different levels necessarily wants to live, totally controlled. And I think that's the struggle that's going on the highest level.
And did you get any indication of which side is good or bad, malevolent or benevolent, or is it sort of like they just each have their own agenda and they just conflict in certain areas?
Yeah, I think it basically has to do, going back with free will, the individual has the right and the choice of free will, whether or not they want to live in this totally structured manner, where everything is clearly defined and the rules are the rules, or if they want to have a little room for independent thought and action.
And do they let you know if what's that?
How about you, Tim? You want to live in a totally structured environment, or do you want a little independent thought and action?
Oh, man, I'll take the independent thought and action any day of the week.
That's why you're on planet Earth, buddy.
Oh, no. I guess I'm stuck here, then.
Yeah, well, not forever, probably.
Probably not.
Yeah. Not if we can get it in gear and get free of the box.
Yeah, well, you know, we're all sort of like pulling on the cart here, and hopefully we can get it up the hill.
It's like a big video game in a way.
How so?
Yeah, well, it's a virtual reality game that we've got ourselves involved in there.
That's for sure.
And we get lots of options and choices, right?
Oh, all kinds of choices. Did the extraterrestrials, did they give you any indication if they're in contact with the U.S. government at all, or is it sort of just to an individual citizenry type of thing?
Yeah, I didn't get an indication of that, but, you know, my research since that time, I can give you my opinion.
Yeah, that's valuable,
well,
you know.
My opinion is that they've definitely been in contact with our government. And I think that there's substantial documentation, you know, out there
for
the individual wants to look. The great, great presentations that we heard at the X conference, you know, so much proof. And, you know, on the Black Vault, there's all the documents there that if a person wants to go to the problem or take the time to do the investigation themselves, you know, they can find out that the government has thousands of pages of documents dealing with UFOs within its own internal structure.
And after the early 70s, you knew this ET phenomenon was real. So in the last 30 years, I think personally, from what my research and everything, has been that there's been a conditioning process going on. You've probably seen it firsthand. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
And you think, what do you think of that? Do you think it's turning out successful and that it's getting the people ready for disclosure?
Well, I think that people are much more ready for disclosure. And one of the things that people that have small children and watch the cartoon channels, they see that the cartoons, in many, many cases now, are made up of not necessarily all humanoid critters, you know.
Yeah.
There's a variety of alien-looking forms there that the younger generation have been exposed to. And as you say, I've watched for 30 years and all the different movies and the different things that come out. And I think that the planet is being conditioned to accept the reality of another level of species out there that has been interacting with us for millions of years.
And how do you think the public reaction would be to something like that if and when they're told?
I don't know if you can just use a blanket number or figure on that, but I think that a lot of it depends if we're told that we have a space-based enemy who's been abducting our people and are in the process of trying to take over the planet or dominate the planet, then I think that the reaction will be one of fear and a great deal of hesitation. On the other hand, if we're told and it's kind of the feeling that you get from Jaime Masson, that he feels that there's a benevolent intelligence out there that's seeking to uplift and help the planet. If it comes across that way, if it's presented that way, and if in reality it is that way, then I think the reaction would be pretty darn good.
Yeah, I think there's an inherent danger with disclosure because, you know, if it's disclosed by the government, we're at the mercy of their intent. So if they're looking to increase their defense budgets and what have you, they could easily say that we were under attack by the extraterrestrials. So the people who aren't as educated as you and me on the subject, they'll might buy it hook, line, and sinker when we might know it's not true at all. So there's a danger there, don't you think?
Yeah, there's a huge danger there. As Michael Sala said, $1.7 trillion a year is being put into the black budgets, you know, which is a just incredible amount of money. And I doubt that we have any idea how far that money has gone to advance the level of technology and sophistication that our governments now possess. I would say that we already have the teleportation devices. We are also already involved interdimensionally with planets in different parts of the system. Not only our local system, but some of the far-reaching galaxies out there. And I think that, you know, we're already there, and the governments are doing those things, and the population is the last to know.
And, all right, Ron, I saw this on your website. I was looking at it, the virtual concept of the Genesis 2.
Right.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about that? Because that was pretty interesting. I thought that might be something that doesn't get talked about much with the whole ET phenomenon thing. So what's that all about?
Well, Genesis 2 is the idea that a group of people could come together and create a community-styled environment somewhere in the world. Ideally, tropical islands always appeal to me, and I've lived on some islands. But because there you generally have abundant natural gifts, you know, which are like the soil will grow, wonderful food and vegetables. You've got the rain usually, you've got fresh water. And it's the idea to bring together a community of people who would actually develop a community somewhere in the world, and that would be called Genesis 2, and there they would have education that would, you know, would not be selective education. You'd get the actual facts. You'd also have advanced structures and technologies. Over the course of the years, having lived on boats, where you had to be totally self-sufficient, you know, there's water generation equipment, machinery, there's wind energy, there's solar energy. There's so many non-polluting, wonderful ways to live that we just don't practice when we live in these cities and we live the way we live now in the traditional Western civilization. And I've experienced the fact that people can live at a different harmonic out there, and the food doesn't have to be chemically sprayed, and you know, the soil doesn't have to be depleted of all of its nutrients. I think there's things that can be done in all the sciences, including the natural medications and things. I don't think we have to die at 73 years of age. I think that there's life extension and a community that comes together that has the right type of people can bring all those ingredients together and have a wonderful way of life as a model. It shows that other people can do it as well. It could happen here in even in our own cities.
Now, this is sort of an odd question, really, I guess, but you probably get it a lot. After your encounter, who did you tell? Your family or your friends or anything right away, or did you sort of keep it to yourself?
No, actually, I did tell a couple of people, and for a couple of weeks, it was like my feet weren't even touching the ground. I had a very difficult time adjusting to the reality, and I began to write all this down. And I actually wrote like a 95 or 100 page manuscript within a period of 6 or 7 months there.
Oh, wow.
And then published it. And then, of course, after publishing it, on a limited scale, was distributed to bookstores. And a producer happened to pick it up and read it, and then Columbia bought it. So I told quite a few people, and of course a lot of people thought I was nuts. And I really didn't care because I was so convinced of it, of its reality.
Yeah.
It was so real to me, just like it's real to me now, even after, 34 years.
Yeah. Well, we were corresponding over the past few months, and you were in Germany. What were you doing over in Germany?
Well, that's part of the documentary project. As a result of the book being published, we connected up a group of people, which is fairly small but hardworking, and we've bought motion picture equipment. We've bought the latest HD cameras and lighting and microphones, and we went out and we began to do the recording of the different experts on the field of ufology, because we felt like this is probably the single item that is suppressing most of the change on the planet. So I went to Germany. We shot the interviews. We went over there to shoot some more footage and to do some more interviews and to work with the one of the senior editors on the project, who's a very interesting fellow. He's an ex-Russian MiG pilot.
Wow.
Who's also, his name is Stoyan, and he's in Bulgaria. He came to Germany for a little over a month. And my associate producer there, Bruce Jessup in Germany, has a facility, and we put together a set where we're in teleprompters, and we have some of the on-set stuff. Another associate, Pete, is a musician from London. He's also doing some editing, and he's doing the camera work. I have a son, Anthony, who's in Phoenix, and he has been shooting and helping on the project as well. He was a cameraman. You met him at the X conference.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
But Germany was about 30 days of working on the script and developing the project and editing and shooting, and there's still more to do.
Oh, wow. Now, did Bruce and I think said the other guy's name was Pete, and Stoyan, did they all have the same experience that you did, or did they just read the book and wanted to help out and join up with the Safe Space project?
Right. Actually, Bruce originally connected up after I did Art Bell on Coast to Coast.
Yeah.
He gave me a call. And he said that he saw the picture of the vessel, the Safe Space One, which is on the cover of the book. He said that it just struck a chord with him. He'd seen the ship before. He studied a lot of the Eastern meditation and yoga for over 25 years, and is also very, very knowledgeable on the whole ufology field and a lot of the other fields which the Safe Space project wants to get into, which is alternative health and a lot of the alternative energy and the different approaches. And Bruce is a very well-read and experienced individual in all those fields. And he kind of like was the group leader that pulled together a number of the other individuals to come and help. And was at his place there in Lübeck, Germany, that we have been working here the last month.
Well, Germany must have been nice in the summertime like that, huh?
Oh, it was beautiful over there. It's right on the Baltic Sea, Lübeck is, and it rains there about every day or every other day, and the weather's nice and mild. Yeah, beautiful city.
Now, after your encounter, did you ever have any run-ins with the government, Men in Black type situations, or any threats or anything like that?
You know, I never did. And part of it probably was because most of the most of the time I was pretty silent about the project, other than going through the period of time with Columbia Pictures and that whole experience. And then a couple of times I decided I would build some prototype vessels, and always at the back of my mind was the desire to build a larger ship or to do a movie. But no, I've never had any Men in Black experiences.
Well, that's good.
Say.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And after this first Fast Walkers files project on ufology, what are some of the other topics you guys are planning on covering? Do you have like a sequel plan already in mind, or?
I think we're going to look at chemtrails.
Oh, wow.
Is another one that is going to be addressed. Alternative health. There's an amazing amount, as you know, I'm sure, of alternative medicine out there.
Oh yeah.
That we just don't know about. Alternative energy. I worked with a little bit with a fellow by the name of Robert Cook that has designed a motor that produces the energy that would drive not only a vessel like the Say Space One, but also a spacecraft without any fuel at all. And it's he's a dynamic inventor and has a lot of knowledge not only of spin dynamics. He has a prototype engine that will produce power to power everything from generators to saltwater desalinators, power spacecraft. That's the Cook engine, and that's one of the devices that we want to promote and to actually create a prototype of.
Wow. And let me throw it back a little bit to your encounter, because I got a couple of little follow-up questions here. You said you thought it felt like about 8 or 9 hours?
Yeah, at least that, yeah.
Did you eat anything?
We went to the briefing, also went out to the beach and spent some time at the beach.
Okay, yeah, I remember you said
Just enjoying the phenomenal energy and the environment there that was there on the planet Jupiter.
And was it like a city there by the beach? Or?
Yeah, there sure was. It was. People have asked me about the buildings and the structures, and I would just have to say they were made of a white, kind of like composite material, it appeared. I don't think it was what it would be concrete, but again, I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. I was more involved in just listening and experiencing than looking at studying the architecture.
And you didn't talk to any of the other people, like the humans that were there. You just didn't. Were they in as much awe as you were about what was going on, or did they seem sort of just like old hat to them? What was their reaction? Have you even noticed it?
You know, I didn't even notice it. My time was spent basically with the person that was my guide, and I in the book I call her Kalina, as far as a name goes. But she was there with me throughout the entire experience, and it was almost like. Although I was part of a larger group, I had a person that was assigned to make sure that the knowledge or the information was imparted to me. And, you know, most of it was just the pure amazement, Tim, of me trying to accept that this reality was even occurring. And that extended even to the time out on the beach, you know, where I said, you know, I know this is happening, but it's so just incredible. I don't know what to.
Yeah, it must be pretty startling. It must have been just trying to figure out I can't even imagine, you know. I wish it would happen to me.
Yeah, well, I wish it would too.
See if you can pull some strings for me, you know.
Yeah.
I'd be more than happy to take a trip. Now, did you eat at all while you were there? Did you go to the bathroom? Like, your everyday type of thing. Did you do anything like that while you were there, or was that all sort of, like, pushed to the side?
Yeah, not to my recollection. Yeah.
So no eating or anything like that?
Yeah, no. That's a good question, though. Again, it seemed like, you know, there was a time dilation, but it seemed to me that it was 8 or 9 hours. But again, in reality, it was 33 minutes. The reason I knew that, when I came back aboard, I looked at my clock.
And no one, and was there anyone else on the boat when you left?
Yes, there was. My partner was on the boat, and he was still asleep. And when I got back to the boat, he was, like, pounding on my stateroom door, calling my name.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And she had told me that there was somebody
looking for you.
Yeah, wanted me.
Did they give you any indication about the other alien races that we've heard about, like the Greys or the Reptilians or any
no,
of the
they
other
sure didn't.
Did you mention anything like that?
No. Except that I know that there had been a lot of contact with this planet from other races, from the local and nearby sectors, which kind of goes back to some of the stuff that's in the book, has to do with what Sitchin would call the Neophim, or the Bible talks about them coming here, and the engineering of the human species as biological entities or servants or workers, you know, to work in the gold mines, to extract the gold from the planet Earth, which appears to be very valuable to spacefaring civilizations.
Yeah. Now, from just your own research and general opinion type of stuff, what do you think of the abduction phenomenon in general?
Well, I think there's definitely a very real component there. I think that a lot of people have been abducted. I think that many of them have been abducted against their will. I guess by definition, abduction would be against your will. But I mean, when in interviewing the one fellow, Stephen Jones, there at Laughlin, he said he turned from a person who was an abductee to a participator. That he actually participated willingly after his first couple of abductions. That they're actually trying to upgrade the human being, the species, for its own good. So I think there's probably some of that going on, and I think that there also has been in the past some of it going on where it wasn't necessarily for our own good.
Yeah. Is there anything that you're looking for help, or how can people help out with this movement and help get things going here?
Well, what we're really working on now, Tim, is the Fast Walker Files, the documentary on disclosure, and we really support the disclosure movement on a worldwide basis, and we invite individuals, if they have any clips, UFO clips, or if they have access to stills of UFOs that they would allow us to use within the context of the documentary, please get in touch with us. And also, if they have interest in the overall project, there is no charge to join or become a Safe Space team member. Basically, it's just an agreement that you support the goals of disclosure and work towards a better planet. And some of that is on the website. So.
And give the URL in case, sometimes, you know, the MP3 is
www.safespaceproject.com. SAFESPACE project, project.com.
When do you expect that first Fast Walker's Files thing to be out?
We want to have our documentary finished and on the market as a DVD prior to the Christmas season. So we should, hopefully we'll be looking October, November.
Who are some of the names in ufology that you have in this, in the Fast Walker Files, in the first edition here?
Well, there's a wide variety of different individuals, but Sergeant Robert Dean is in there. Michael Sala, who is very involved in the exopolitic movement. Also, Alfred Weber, Dolores Cannon, Dr. Lynn Horowitz, who is very interesting, talking about population control, some of the things that are going on. Wendell Stevens, Jim Mars, Sean David Morton, who's interestingly very prophetic individual. Stephen Jones, who is an abductee from London. H.H. Gavard. Charles Hall, who and Paula Harris, who have a very, very interesting story that they've told. Jaime Masson from Mexico, Dr. Richard Boylan. Also Stephen Bassett, who put on the X Conference, did a great job of it. Monsignor Peraldo Balducci, of course, also covered the entire press conference, which, as you know, had a large number of individuals, but in-depth interviews with James Deardorff, Bruce McAbee. Got some clips. We're in the process of editing, so some of these names, I think I'm giving you ones that will actually be in the documentary. Stanton Friedman, a good interview with Stanton. John Greenwald of Black Vault.
So you got quite an international contingent of people in this thing with AJ, he's from Brazil, and Jaime Masson's from Mexico, and Corrado Balducci's from Italy, and Dr. Michael Sell is from Australia originally. So that's quite a worldwide scope of experts here for this. That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, we wanted to give it a broad international approach because you know, the UFO phenomena, as you know, is from the standpoint of the average American, we don't really get to hear much unless we happen to tune in to Peter Jennings, you know?
Yeah.
We still didn't hear much.
I know, we didn't get much from him anyway.
Yeah. But, no, we've got a good list of very dynamic and informed people who have really made it their way of life to investigate this phenomenon and bring the information forward.
And, how about for a final question? What would you say to the young generation like myself? I'm only 26 years old. You know, the future, I'm not sure if it looks bright or if it looks dark, but, you know, what kind of advice would you give for someone who's just beginning in the field and starting to chase after these answers?
Well, I think, Tim, what you're doing is terrific, that you're actually providing an information conduit out there. Using the most modern technology in the world, the internet, to take and bring the truth to people who are interested in hearing about it. So I would encourage everyone, you know, to ask the questions. Just don't accept the standard dribble of denial that's coming out. To look beyond the surface. And to get the information firsthand, to search things out for themselves, and to try to tune in on what's going on an international basis. And that's not necessarily easy. We thank God for the internet.
That's for sure. And the book is Safe Space, and where can you get that, Amazon?
You can get it on Amazon, and you can also get it from the publisher, which is iUniverse.com.
Okay.
But Amazon's got a good price on it and good delivery times. And
nice. And your website's safespaceproject.com, right?
You bet, safespaceproject.com. Hey, I really admire you for putting your show together and your website. I've been on your site, and it's an interesting site. And look forward to see what you're doing with this next series of interviews.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being a part of it. Probably a story that I haven't really told. I might have mentioned it in the first interview, but I think it's worth mentioning here in the second one for the people that are listening at home, is that when I showed up in Washington for the second X conference this past April, I think you were probably one of the first three people I met, and you were you and your son, and you guys were amazingly kind and generous and accommodating to me the whole weekend. And the UFO field is, it's very cliquish. And it's very, you know, tribal, as Michael Sell said to me once when we were talking about it. And you guys really opened up your arms to me and sort of, like, helped me out an awful lot. So I really appreciate that. I'll always remember that. So, you know, when I started putting together this list of people to be part of the first series of interviews for the website, you were definitely on the top of the list. And I want to thank you for you know, giving me all this time to talk about your experience and your work and your upcoming film. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it, and I'm sure the people who are listening to the interview at home are definitely interested in seeing it.
Hey, well, it's been a privilege and a pleasure to work with you, and I know it wasn't an easy job at the X conference because you were trying to get your interviews done, and everybody was trying to do what they had to do and man their tables and make their talks, but you're a pleasure to work with, and I wish you the very best of luck, and I want to thank you for having me as a guest.
Well, thanks a lot.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio, Season 1. I want to thank Robert Miles for sitting down and talking to us. Also want to thank Leslie and Chiron from banalofamerica.com for your continued help and support with the website. And, of course, I want to thank all you great listeners out there. Thanks for downloading the episodes, listening to them, spreading the word. If you like what you hear, you know, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell your loved ones, put it up on your blog or your website. And, you know, keep the word going around here for Banal of America Audio Season 1. We got some big things planned, some great guests upcoming. Next week, Greg Bishop. He's the author of the critically acclaimed book Project Beta. It's the story of Paul Benowitz. Everybody was talking about it last spring. It's still going around. Everybody was raving about this book. And, crazily enough, Greg Bishop will be joining us here at Banal of America Audio Season 1 next week, part one of a marathon session. 3 hours plus that we got with Greg Bishop. We're going to run the first half next week, the second half the week after that. So come by next week on October 15th to banalofamerica.com for Banal of America Audio Season 1. Until then, this is Tim Banal signing off.